On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Novelist Gary Steingart emigrated to the United States from Leningrad when he was 7 years old. While he was growing up in the USA, his home country was breaking up from exhausted Soviet Union into wild and woolly post-Soviet disunion. Gangsters, crime, illicit fortunes, oligarchs, and young Gary Steingart kept watching. In 2002, he came out with his best-selling first novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. Now he's back with Absurdistan, a raucous satire of globe-circling American dreams playing out absurdly in a post-Soviet kleptocracy. Up next on Point, gangster rap, dirty money, cockeyed dreams, and novelist Gary Steingart on Absurdistan. Gary Steingart joins me in the studio. He's author of the best-selling novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. His new novel, Absurdistan, prompted Walter Kiern in the New York Times Book Review to proclaim that, compared with most young novelists his age, Steingart is a giant mounted on horseback. Gary Steingart, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be here.
That's some horse you've got there.
Well, I think of myself more as a kind of short man mounted on a Shetland pony, if you will.
You must have been relieved. April 25, Michiko Kakutani comes out with a review. So-so. 5 days later, Walter Kiern, over the moon. He loves this. He's got you mounted on horseback, a giant among men.
I know. First I was spanked, and then I was praised. I love it.
You came to the United States when you were 7 years old. Tell us about your family. What brought you to this country?
I came in 1980. It was the time of detente, but I remember growing up being Russian wasn't easy back then. There were all those movies, you know, Red Dawn, Red Hamster, Red Gerbil, all these
danger,
movies.
Menace.
Menace to society. Yeah. That's how people saw me. But my parents left for the way many Russian or Soviet Jews did at the time, left for partly for religious reasons, partly for economic reasons, and also because the Soviet Union, you could almost sense that it wasn't headed in a very good direction.
But you're clearly not writing this off of active memories from your life pre-7. What's been your interaction with? I mean, here you went to Oberlin College. You came from Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, to the States, Queens originally. Ended up at Oberlin. I mean, you've grown up essentially American since age 7. So what informs this very nuanced sort of wild view, intimate view of post-Soviet existence?
Well, I never felt quite at home in America in many ways, and I wonder if that's because my parents were very concentrated on Russian culture. We only spoke Russian in the house. We only read Russian books. American television wasn't allowed, which you can imagine made me quite a freak when I showed up in elementary school. So to me, life really was about Russia. It was sort of life interrupted. And as soon as I could, I got on a plane back to Russia, and I've been going back ever since. And some of the people I care about the most are still in Russia. I don't like to go to weddings, but I'm flying into Petersburg for a wedding in August. So it really has shaped my life to a very large extent, and it has been very instrumental to the kind of fiction I write. And I think a lot of Americans are looking back at their heritage, trying to find where they came from several generations down the line. For me, that circuit is closed a lot quicker.
It's
about 5 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Take us into the story of Absurdistan. Give us the broad outline of it, and then I wish you'd read just a little bit from the very beginning of the book to introduce us to your protagonist, Misha Weinberg.
Sure. The story came about actually when I was at Oberlin College, and there was a guy living next to me, a Russian-American like myself, but so different from myself. I was, like many Soviet immigrants, meek. I felt myself a stranger in a strange land. I wasn't exactly sure what was going on around me. But this guy, who was, like my character, fairly large,
325 pounds, your Misha Weinberg here.
He wasn't exactly 325, but he was getting up there. And he was raising some kind of psychedelic frogs in his dorm room. He was a man about campus. Women were throwing themselves at his feet. So, you know, I really felt that this was a new kind of Russian, so much different from me. Mm. And I wanted to make him the center of this book. And Misha Weinberg grows up in Leningrad, but is educated at a place called Accidental College, which is, of course, a stand-in for a place like Oberlin. And he only dreams of moving back to New York and going out with his very attractive Latina girlfriend, Rowena Sales. Mm-hmm. But his father, a Russian oligarch, the 1,238th richest man, ends up killing an Oklahoman businessman. And because of this, Misha is denied entry into the United States.
So he's marooned. He's stuck after almost a decade in the USA.
That's
he's
right.
Stuck back in post-Soviet hell, in his view. In
his view, yes. And the whole novel is him writing a sort of plea to the INS to allow him entry back into the United States. And eventually he ends up in this country named Absurdistan, trying to buy citizenship, fake Belgian citizenship, from a very crooked counselor.
Read us in a little bit here. He describes himself to us, Misha Weinberg, right at the beginning. Gary Steingart, take us away.
I am Misha Borisovich Weinberg, age 30. A grossly overweight man with small, deeply set blue eyes, a pretty Jewish beak that brings to mind the most distinguished breed of parrot, and lips so delicate you would want to wipe them with the naked back of your hand. For many of my last years, I have lived in St. Petersburg, Russia, neither by choice nor by desire. The city of the Tsars, the Venice of the North, Russia's cultural capital, forget all that. By the year 2001, our St. Leninsburg has taken on the appearance of a phantasmagoric third world city. Our neoclassical buildings sinking into the crap-choked canals, bizarre peasant huts fashioned out of corrugated metal and plywood colonizing the broad avenues with their capitalist iconography, cigarette ads featuring an American football player catching a hamburger with a baseball mitt. And what is worst of all, our intelligent, depressive citizenry has been replaced by a new race of mutants dressed in studied imitation of the West. Young women in tight lycra, their scooped-up little breasts pointing at once to New York and Shanghai. Men in fake black Calvin Klein jeans hanging limply around their caved-in asses. The good news is that when you're an incorrigible fatso like me, 325 pounds at last count, and the son of the 1,238th richest man in Russia, all of St. Leninsburg rushes out to service you. The drawbridges lower themselves as you advance, and the pretty palaces line up alongside the canal banks, thrusting their busty friezes in your face. You are blessed with the rarest treasure to be found in this mineral-rich land. You are blessed with respect.
Gary Steingart reading from his new novel, Absurdistan. They're introducing us to Misha Weinberg, 325 pounds, son of an oligarch, therefore on his father's death, an oligarch himself, but not the standard cut of cloth, not the gangster, the thug, but the lips so delicate you want to wipe them with your hand. Oh, what a picture. And he ends up, of course, in something, I don't know, something like Azerbaijan, some kind of oil-rich former Soviet republic desperately longing to get out of there.
Right. When he ends up to this country, to Absurdistan, it's known as the Norway of the Caspian because there's so much oil and so much wealth supposedly to go around. But it only takes a few days for it to become the Rwanda of the Caspian as a completely needless civil war breaks out between two ethnic groups that have absolutely everything in common and no reason to fight. And, of course, the reason behind this is oil.
Introduce us to some more of the characters here. They populate. They're very robust and sort of over the top. I mean, you've got Misha with his wonderful view of the world. His girlfriend, as you said, Rowena Salas. You might tell us something about her. And then some of the others in your palette. They're pretty great.
Well, there's Rowena Salas, of course, who is Misha's lover, whom he has rescued from a kind of go-go bar in Lower Manhattan. But unfortunately for Misha, while he's trapped in Russia, Rowena has enrolled at Hunter College, and there she meets Misha's arch nemesis, the horrible writer Jerry Steinfarb, who has written a book whose title is a little too pornographic, I think, for the radio.
But let us say his surname is very similar to your own, and the book he's written is very much like your first book in title anyway, The Russian Debutante's Handbook,
right.
And something else,
yeah.
And here we go.
So he's
a kind of send-up of yourself, at least in form.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to make fun of sort of literary novelists.
Mm-hmm.
Because after my first book came out, I was thrust mildly into the limelight, and people were asking me questions about everything. What do you think of the cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad?
Right,
what do you
right.
think of burqas? And for a while, I kept answering these questions, and then I thought, what the heck do I know about these things? What a pompous ass I am. So I decided to poke a little gentle fun at myself by creating this kind of character, Jerry Steinfarb.
So he wants to be the Jewish Nabokov, as you have it in the book. And Rowena, of course, Misha's very jealous that she may go for him. You've got gangsters aplenty in here, one or two of which assassinate Misha's dad.
Right, exactly. Oleg the Moose and his syphilitic cousin Zhora are the two people that assassinate his father because a feud breaks out over a bunch of sort of subway-style hero restaurants in the middle of St. Petersburg. Actually, there is some truth behind that. There was a huge fight broke out about subway-style hero sandwich restaurants in St. Petersburg.
You've got, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands in here, but begin to walk us into some of the absurdities that caught that catch your eye when you look that way and back this way, Gary Steinberg?
Well, it's really funny. I mean, I did spend a lot of time in that part of the world, and everywhere I went, maybe there's something about me, maybe there's something smarmy about me that attracts this strange element of people, this strange class of people. But wherever I go, at one point, one gentleman kept wanting to kidnap me. Every morning we'd wake up, I was traveling with him, he'd say, please, let me kidnap you. I bet we can get a really nice ransom at a Random House. And I said, have you seen my last sales figures? You know, I don't think we're looking at that much. And at one point, I was walking down Rustaveli, the main avenue in Tbilisi, Georgia, and this gentleman comes up to me and says, you know, hey, you look like a big Jew to me. And I said, yeah, I'm a pretty big Jew. And he said, well, my mother, in this country, Jews are our favorite people. You will always find peace in our land. My mother will be your mother. My brother will be your brother. There will always be water in my well to drink. And I said, that is so sweet. Thank you. And then he took out a giant knife and started to mug me. And I thought,
welcome.
And I thought, well, this is an absurd. He said, well, our mother needs help. She's in the hospital, so give me your money. Yeah. And I was thinking to myself, this is the perfect metaphor for sort of what happened in Russia. You know, we grew up after the collapse of the Soviet Union. We thought that democracy, free markets, et cetera, things were going to look a lot better. But then the knife came out. And I think we all, and for the majority of the population, their savings were lost. In many cases, their national pride was lost. Culture was lost. So it became a good metaphor, for what's happening in these absurdistans.
They say write what you know, and you seem to know from your own experience or that of people close to you a fair bit out of this. There's a great piece at the beginning where Misha Weinberg is being sent off to the study in the States at Accidental College somewhere in the great Midwest, and he's talking with his father about expectations. I wish you could read a bit of that for us, Gary Steinberg.
Absolutely, I would love to. Mishka, my papa said, soon you'll be in America, studying interesting subjects, sleeping with the local Jewish girls, and enjoying the life of the young. And as for your papa, well, he'll be all alone here in Russia, with no one to care if he's dead or alive. I nervously squeezed at my thick left breast, funneling it into a new oblong shape. I noticed a stray piece of salami peel on the table and wondered if I could eat it without Papa noticing. It was your idea that I should go to Accidental College, I said. I'm only doing as you say. I'm letting you go because I love you, said my father, because there's no future in this country for a little popka like you. He grabbed the floating dirigible of my right hand, my masturbatory hand, and held it tight between his two little ones. The broken capillaries of his cheek stood out beneath his graying stubble. He was crying silently. He was drunk. I started crying, too. It had been 6 years since my father had told me he loved me or wanted to hold my hand. 6 years since I had ceased being a pale little angel whom adults love to tickle and school bullies love to punch and turn instead into a giant florid Jaime with big squishy hands and a rather mean-looking overbite. Almost twice the size of my father I was, which stunned us both pretty hard. Maybe there was some kind of recessive Polish gene on my miniature mother's side. Yasnowski was her maiden name, so new. I need you to do something for me, Mishka, Papa said, wiping his eyes. I sighed again, slipping the salami peel into my mouth with my free hand. I knew what was required of me. Don't worry, Papa. I won't eat anymore, I said. And I'll do exercises with the big ball you bought for me. I'll be thin again, I swear. And once I get to Accidental, I'll study hard how to become an American.
Gary Steingart reading from his new novel, Absurdistan. And, of course, that's not what his father expects. He said, come on, get off it. You'll always be, you're not going to be an American. You're going to be a Jew, 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 in your words. And the thing he wants from him is to be circumcised, which he had never been. So much I want to ask you about here, but let me ask you this. The thing that everybody loves about this book is how robust the language is, the imagery. It's so vigorous, so vibrant, so funny. You describe coming as a young immigrant with your family to the States and staying in kind of a bubble, inside a Russian bubble, transported to North America. So where does the funny, vigorous, over-the-top Gary Steingart comes from? Are you all having all that fun inside that bubble? We just don't know about it?
Well, I grew up in a very satirical household. The first things I heard growing up, even before I heard a lullaby, I think, were Brezhnev jokes. You know, I grew up with nothing but Brezhnev jokes. And, you know, just the stuff on the table, the works of Isaac Babel, and later as I grew up, the works of Philip Roth, Saul Bellow. Mm-hmm. There is such a rich tradition of Russian humor and Jewish humor, and they have a lot in common. I think it's both are sort of a humor from the edge of the grave kind of stuff, which fits in perfectly if you want to write a satirical novel about about a country experiencing oil politics circa 2001 or even civil wars and ethnic strife and genocide. So I think my background prepared me quite well for this kind of work.
So then your family looked out into the American reality from that vantage. Meanwhile, back in the Soviet Union, then former Soviet Union, the world was rushing in. American culture was rushing in, a very different tempo and feeling and temperature than Russian culture in the Soviet era. What's the meeting of those been like?
Well, here's what I think is going on in my point of view. You know, I always thought growing up that Russia would become more and more like America with the advent of more democratic freedoms, the free market. But in the end, I think America is becoming more and more like Russia. I mean, you look at the latest scandals in the newspapers, a country that spies on its own citizens. That's something right out of the Brezhnev playbook, you know. And then you look at, for example, Dick Cheney was just in Kazakhstan, one of the most autocratic, corrupt regimes around. And he said to the president, he said, I really admire the economic and political progress you have in this country. I really admire your system, you know, heck of a job, Brownie, that sort of thing. And it's so shocking to see that happen because you almost think, does Cheney really think that this kind of system is what he has in mind for us? Are we all living in Absurdistan at this point? Because when I started writing this book, Absurdistan referred to simply a part of the world. But now I think it's more of a frame of mind.
Gary Steingart is with us. His new novel is Absurdistan. Let's turn to our listeners. Rick is calling from Los Angeles. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Hey, hi there. I'm just curious. Your both books obviously had Russian themes. Were you going to continue as a writer of Russian things, or do you think you'd broaden the palette?
I'm going to broaden that palette. There's only so much I could do without being pigeonholed as the Russian writer. So my next book is going to take quite a different turn. It's going to be called, it's going to be set in 2040 in an evangelical city-state called All Holy Albany Rensselaer, which is run by the maniacal Korean-American Reverend Cho.
Oh, so you're bringing it right home.
I'm bringing it right home. I've traveled all across the Absurdistans, and I think I finally landed in the one that I appreciate the most.
Rick, thanks for your call. Gary Steingart, what about yourself? How do you understand, you know, the voice inside? Is it Russian? Is it American? Is Russian American? how do you understand yourself in national terms?
It's very hard to say. Sometimes I feel like I'm the product of a lot of tectonic plates sort of brushing against one another. I don't feel very, you know, I'm just part of a very long book tour. And when I'm on the coasts, I feel pretty relaxed. In the interior of the country, I feel pretty anxious. In Russia, I feel happy to see the people that I love so much, and yet at the same time, very depressed by the political situation. I've lived in Europe for a while, which I find, from a sensory standpoint, to be absolutely wonderful, but I don't really belong there either. So I think when it all is said and done, I'm just a New Yorker. I'm just a resident of the Lower East Side. That's the one place where I go and where nobody tries to kill me or kidnap me or try to get them involved in some kind of strange Ponzi scheme.
Not a bad global passport in this day and age just to be a New Yorker. Galina's calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Galina. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. What do you hear, Galina?
I was listening to the radio show, and it's great to see somebody emerging with the satirical view of Russia and post-Russia. I haven't been back since 96 when I came here with my family. And I guess I do have a question. You've heard Zadornov, right? The Russian humorist?
No, I haven't. I'm sorry.
No, you haven't?
No.
Introduced us to is it Zadornov?
Zadornov.
Uh-huh. He's a Russian humorist. He was making fun of America in Russia, and I grew up listening to him, and he's hilarious and funny, and so that kind of parallelism reminded me of him.
Oh, great. Well, I'm going to check him out as soon as I can.
Huh?
I will check him out as soon as I can, Zadornov. I'm writing it down.
I'll definitely get the book. It's great to hear you on the radio, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Galina, thanks for your call. We're at 1-800-423-8255 with Gary Steingart, author of Absurdistan. 1-800-423-TALK. Gary, a couple of places in the book, people talk about America nonstop in this book. Misha Weinberg is obsessed with it because he wants to get back there. Talk to us about his obsession, from his standpoint as a very wealthy Russian oligarch of huge appetites, and the broader Russian or post-Soviet view that you see. There's a passage I remember where people are talking about, oh, I wish America would fall down. I can't wait for America to get its comeuppance. The perspective from that side of the world on this side of the world, as you see it.
Right. Well, I remember that after right after 9/11, and I was living maybe 20 blocks away from the World Trade Center at the time, there was this huge rush of emails from my friends from that part of the world saying, you know, our sorrow is with America, is with the citizens of New York and Washington. And there was a real outpouring of grief, a kind of outpouring that I think only Russians are really capable of. And then after a while, things started to change. We began to invade several countries. And the emails started to change in tone as well. People from the Absurdistan part of the world would email me and say, I've been living in ground zero all my life. There's ethnic strife. There's people dying all around me. There's malnutrition. I've been living in ground zero all my life, and nobody cares. Nobody seems to want to know anything about our part of the world. And so when I was writing Absurdistan, I made a very conscious decision to end the action on September 10th, 2001, because I didn't want it to be about what happened with the United States. There are plenty of novels that will be dealing with this. I wanted to focus on that part of the world and leave it there.
But when you get those emails today, when people look over, how do you see it? If you're going to go off now and write about Koreans in 2040, before you go, Korean-American religionists, before you go, expand on that. How Russians, how folks in post-Soviet Russia see the United States these days. We saw Dick Cheney lecturing Putin not long ago.
Right.
Is he seen to have a pillar, a leg, a box to stand on?
I think most Russians see America very negatively, which doesn't make them unique in the world, I think. A lot of people see America very negatively. But I think that at the same time, they aspire to an American lifestyle. They want all the things that America has to offer. And I think that Misha is the ultimate example of that. He can be critical of all kinds of political systems, but Misha Weinberg is at heart a consumer. At 325 pounds, he's certainly a consumer of food. In the novel, he eats sturgeon by the dozen.
Right.
He's a consumer of women. He has many girlfriends who love him. He's a consumer of all kinds of political ideas. And for him, you know, his little red book, it isn't Mao's little red book. Mm. It's the Zagat survey to New York. Mm. And he's memorized that Zagat survey by heart. And throughout the book, he makes sort of love poetry out of it and uses the Zagat survey to seduce young women. And I think that's sort of the idea of the consumerist new Russian that I wanted to create.
But that's the sort of glutton, bon vivant, rich boy's view of America. The broader one, you say unpopular because why? Is it the same old kind of rivalry that we knew from so many decades from Cold War period, or is it tinged with something new?
Well, in the book, I think Misha says, in Absurdistan, Misha says, the Cold War is over and one side won and one side lost. And I think that's something that's in the back of the minds of many Russian people, is the fact that the collapse of the Soviet Union has meant that Russia is no longer really a great power. The military is falling apart. The economy is booming right now in the oil and natural gas sector, but that only benefits a very small percentage of the population in any real way.
Mm.
So you have people who are brought up to think that we are the greatest power in the world, and all of a sudden the rug has been pulled out from under them. There's nothing to suggest that they're a mighty country. So this, and then you look at a world which is at this point very unipolar. Only America really has the rights, the bragging rights, to be the sole superpower. And you add to that the fact that there has already been traditionally a rivalry this century between America and Russia. And you can see how Russians would want America to get its comeuppance.
Talk to us about the oligarchs. You can't go anywhere these days, major cities. I was in London not long ago, and, because I was traveling, I was in hotels, and, I mean, the lobbies were just jammed with very wealthy, apparently, Russians who were sort of there for tea, there for dinner, da-da-da. They inhabit this sort of rich vein of the world now. What's the oligarch nature, character, perspective?
Well, they used to be very interesting that they used to dress. The idea of the Russian oligarch was sort of this guy in a Puma tracksuit, you know, wandering around. But I think as the years change, they are now trying to sort of gild their image a little bit to become more of a kind of more smooth, less of these gigantic Versace double-breasted suits, less flashy. But they're still very interesting because their mentality in many ways is very Soviet. And I think a lot of them are very worried about their wealth because in a country like Russia, today you're wealthy, tomorrow you're in prison. The best example of that is the oligarch Khodorkovsky.
With his oil business and politics, ultimately leaving him behind bars.
Behind bars. He crossed Putin. He thought he could get away with challenging Putin politically. He was in a labor camp before he could say da, you know, and he was recently beaten up in the labor camp. It's a terrible situation. So these oligarchs are you know, when I see these oligarchs, it's really nothing new. You could take one of these oligarchs, in a sense, you could put them in Indonesia, you could put them in Nigeria, you can put them in Brazil, you can put them in any other country where there is a terrible inequity of wealth.
Could you put them in 1899 Russia? Or are they on the different, on this side of the Soviet era, are they of a different ilk?
I think they're of a much different ilk, I think, because the Soviet Union did so much to eviscerate any kind of moral stance that could have preceded even the Russian Revolution. I mean, there's a restaurant in St. Petersburg, for example, called The Year 1913. And I always wonder, and I said, what is this about? And he said, well, the year 1913 was the only good year in Russian history. So I think that in many ways, there is an authoritarian system. There was a very brief window of possibility for Russia to emerge as a more enlightened country, I think, from 1913 to 1917, the provisional government. And I think once that failed, and under Yeltsin also, there was this feeling that, you know, that something good can come of this. When Yeltsin was standing on that tank, I think all Russians felt so proud and so happy that the system was being challenged. And yet, a mere 13 years down the road, and what do you have? You have a complete suppression of media freedoms. Mm. You have a tiny elite that might as well be the Politburo, except now they control oil and natural gas. So it's such a terrible reversion to the past, and it's so sad to see. And Absurdistan, you know, it's a satire and it's comic. But on the other hand, what I have to deal with is a very tragic scenario for not just for Russia, for Absurdistan, but for all the different countries of the former Soviet Union. So there's a lot of sadness in there.
Almost everyone in the book that swirls around are Fat Misha, sort of brutish and nasty and short-tempered and depraved in a thousand ways. You know, from my time in Russia, and most of it was Soviet, you know, it had such a rich kind of intellectual, slow, contemplative feeling to it. My conversations there were distinctly not like many conversations in the United States. I mean, love it or hate it, it was very different. But you describe something now kind of speeded up and hepped up and hot and having lost that intellectual depth that we associate with what was a hard time in Russia.
Right, exactly. Although there are some echoes of the past. For instance, there's a scene where clearly, a gentleman who's a killer, a mafioso, tells Misha to stop rapping. Misha loves to rap a lot. He says, "Stop rapping and start quoting Pushkin." You know, so I think there are some echoes of that. What's really sad to see when I go back to Russia is how literature, which used to be the second Bible for most Russians, or even the first Bible, because it was such a secular society, how that has faded from the scene, how fewer Russians read serious fiction, especially younger Russians. That is something very strange. I remember Sorokin, Vladimir Sorokin, who wrote the brilliant book Goluboya Sala in Russian. In English, it's called Blue Lard. Mm. And only that got people's attention, because there was a scene of Khrushchev and Stalin making love. With Khrushchev being the dominant partner. And that got a lot of senior citizens very upset. And they built a giant toilet bowl outside of the Bolshoi Theater, and they started flushing his books down the toilet. And I thought, well, on the one hand, this is terrible. They're destroying these books. But on the other hand, in what country will books still matter so much
that people will
build a giant toilet?
Right. Peter's calling from Boston. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. My family left on both sides, left Russia before the First World War. Mostly the guys were getting drafted to go off and fight the Japanese, and they weren't really crazy about doing that.
Before the First World War, so we're talking nearly a century ago.
And I wondered if the people who'd come early, how you felt, you as a more recent immigrant. It seems as though we're really coming from two different worlds. You know, especially in terms of Judaism and all of that, you know, because the Russians pretty much wiped out religion during the time it was Soviet.
Gary, what about the layers? If you look at the layers of Russian immigrants that you're familiar with, I mean, Peter's goes way back a century or more, but how do you see the layers, the waves, the generation of immigrants? Do you relate, you know, to one in particular? Do you see some things in common?
Well, I think Soviet Jews, for example, and American Jews are very different societies, very different groups of people. Now I see, as more of my generation grows up, we are sort of entering more of the American mainstream, as everyone does. But I remember when we came to this country, growing up in a Soviet system, which was so radically different from anything America had to offer, not just in terms of the range of goods and services, but in terms of ideology, in terms of the way people treated each other, just in terms of the way you would smile in America walking down the street, which you would never do in Russia, that I think the 70 years of Soviet rule have left such an indelible mark on that society that I think that the waves of immigration that I've experienced have very little to do with those people that came, let's say, before the Russian Revolution.
And those that came after. I mean, there too. You came at a time when it was Soviet Jews coming out by and large. Now it seems to be much more mixed, for the past some years, a much more mixed outflow. Are Russian emigres very conscious of being from sort of different neighborhoods back home, if you will?
Sure, of course. There's all kinds of different immigrants. In New York, where I live, for example, there's a new wave of immigrants from Uzbekistan, the Bukhara Jews, who, and I thought that we as Soviet Jews had a lot in common, but this is a completely different ballgame. These people have a much more Eastern kind of attitude toward life, much more familial, much more religious. I came from a very different generation, although, for example, when I read that scene about Misha being circumcised late in life, that's not something that's completely alien to me. I gave it the office as well when it came to Judaism.
We've got it. Peter, thank you very much for your call. Let me get a call from Burlington. Not quite yet. Let's go to, we've got a bunch here, but they're jammed at the moment. Let's go to Absurdistan itself. By the time Misha Weinberg, your protagonist, gets down there, he's still desperate to get back to Rowena, his lovely, back in the States. But Americans are very much on the scene in this oil-rich Absurdistan. There's a scene here you described, just a short one, where he's interacting with, you tell us, set it up.
Well, Misha has just landed in Absurdistan, and he's about to get his fake Belgian passport. But at the same time, he steps out of his hotel room, and here's what happens. As I stepped into the corridor, I was waylaid by a tall, tanned beauty with electric lips, a clingy camisole reaching down to her hot pants. "Golly Burton, Golly Burton," she said. "You Golly Burton?" She poked at me with an audacious finger. Her face was as powdered as an American donut. "Eh?" I said. "Golly Burton, KBR, 30% discount for you." She grabbed my hand and pressed it to her wet forehead. "Oofa, I have such hot temperature for Golly Burton. 30% discount. You so aroused, mister." "I don't understand this Golly Burton," I said in Russian. "Do you mean Halliburton? 30% discount for Halliburton?" The woman spat on the floor. "You're a Russian," she hissed. "Fat, dirty Russian. Don't touch me, disgusting Russian." She stomped away in her impossibly high heels. "That's racism, miss," I yelled after her. "Come back and apologize."
I love that. There's accidental college speaking in Absurdistan. "That's racism, miss." But help us understand this. I mean, what's going on here? Well, you tell us.
Well, this was from an experience I had at in a certain country on the Caspian Sea, where I was hanging around this area where all the prostitutes and all the oil executives would hang out. It was very sad to see a lot of these oil. They weren't all executives either. There were some of them, I think, were just KBR, Kellogg Brown and Root workers in the oil fields or
part of Halliburton.
Right. And sometimes you'd see an older gentleman go away with a woman for maybe 10 minutes, and he would come back and say, "Dang, she didn't even kiss me. She just wanted to get right at it." You know, it was very sad to see. And one woman came up to me and asked me if I worked for Golly Burton, and I said, "No, I'm just a Russian writer." And she said, "Poo!"
Forget about it.
"No discount for you."
But the American footprint is right there in the book. Oil is very important, and when that's not quite forthcoming enough, geopolitics and security issues are pulled in and manipulated quite directly.
Exactly. And I think this is what's going on that is so sad, is that our administration is so short-sighted in the way it deals with these countries. For example, there's a country named Belarus, which is an awful dictatorship near Ukraine, which has no oil. And America censors this government. The European Union has ostracized it. Members of the government can't even travel, like Misha Weinberg, they can't get visas to the States. And then you look at a country like Kazakhstan or like Azerbaijan, which is another dictatorship where human rights are routinely suppressed. And America embraces these countries. The Bush administration invites the president over to the White House, all because they have oil. And people aren't stupid. They can see very clearly the cynical way that the administration deals with these different countries. And that has a huge effect down the line. You look at a lot of of these countries, mm-hmm. for example, they're Muslim republics. These are the people that we should be courting instead of alienating them by reaching out
that
to these corrupt
the people,
elites.
Not necessarily the elites, but the people that should be courted.
The people should be courted, exactly. And the elites should be ostracized and punished for their actions.
And Gary Steingart sees it just as upside down from that. Robin's calling from Boston. Hi, Robin. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just came back from Moscow last week and was there during the whole the Cheney visit to Kazakhstan. I also lived there from 91 to 99, and I just agree completely with the sort of sense of cynicism and transparency that nobody can take seriously at all there any kind of moral authority emanating from the U.S. government at the moment, which is such a far cry from what I saw arriving in 91, which was this huge, great euphoria and exuberance and excitement for Russia becoming a, you know, quote, normal country. But then over the decade, it was almost like a balloon that was punctured and so the air was slowly leaking out to the point of the Kosovo bombing in 99, where I don't know if that quite made it to the American press, but I flew in that day and Moscow and was greeted by a friend who said, "Have you heard the Americans have invaded Yugoslavia and they're going to invade us next?" And a grenade was launched at the U.S. Embassy, and normal citizens would throw cans of tomato sauce and paint at the embassy. And it's a sad thing to see coming from the end of the Cold War, this wonderful friendship. But over the years, it really has degraded to a point where America isn't taken seriously and doesn't really have any moral authority in the conversation oil and democratic rights. It's been sad to see.
Robin, thanks for the report. Gary Steingart, what about it, this issue of moral authority? You've already said America has lost no small part of its standing there, but more broadly, I mean, who does have moral authority in the post-Soviet world?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, when I look around the world, I don't see people often say, well, your work is so cynical and you have such a terrible view of things. But when I look around the world, to be honest, I don't see very many heroes around the world. Not even speaking about an individual level, but in terms of societies, I don't see any heroic actions by anyone at this point. I don't see the European Union acting heroically. I don't see China. I don't see any other countries looking out for anything except their basic interests. So I think that this book focuses on Russia and America, but a case can be made for different countries around the world.
Artyom is calling from Burlington, Massachusetts. Artyom, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Artyom, and I have a replica about the Soviet Union and former Soviet republics. I came from Belarus, Minsk, and of course, this is probably the most absurd country right now in Europe, because it's kind of going back to the Soviet era.
Right.
And the dictatorship and so on. But my replica is about that I was traveling a lot around the Europe after the Soviet Union collapsed, and many people were asking me why it's happening in Russia, in other republics, why it doesn't go like it was planned with all this new economy and new politics.
Why didn't it turn out better, you mean it?
Right, why it's going to all this corruption and so on. So my basic answer was, well, you living in Germany or in England, just show us a good example, how to live without corruption, how to behave with your neighbors and with other countries without big conflicts and so on. Just show us example and maybe all other republics will follow your path.
So maybe you're still waiting for that example.
Right, that's the main point. You have to show example to Russia and all republics that you are good for us.
Artyom, we've got it. Our time is short. Let me put it to Gary Steingart. Is that fair? I mean, what we hear and you write in a huge satire, but what we hear is this kind of out of control oligarchs and gangsters and all the rest. Is it really so that there's not a better model than that out there somewhere? Maybe right here.
I think there are much better models out there. I think Canada would be a wonderful model for Russia. But I always used to think that a country like the Netherlands had so much to offer. I think one of the things that's changed, or maybe hasn't changed for a while, is the terrible sense of xenophobia that I feel that still emanates from Russia, which makes the country grasps and has always grasped for Western ideals. You read the works of Russian literature in the 19th century. There's a constant conflict between the Westerners and the Slavophiles, those people that think that countries like England or France need to be emulated, and others that think that there's a distinctly nationalist Russian idea. But what worries me very much, especially as Putin sort of turns inward, as he kicks out non-government environmental organizations which are trying to foster human rights in Russia, is that I see this slipping down from the high up, from Putin to the average population. And the scariest thing I see these days are these constant attacks on foreigners in Moscow and Petersburg and other cities. A 9-year-old Tajik girl was recently murdered. Another 9-year-old who's a half African was beaten, was stabbed.
Just on the street.
Just on the street in broad daylight. And the police don't do anything. They say, oh, this is just hooliganism. This is not racial strife. And where does all this come from? It comes from the top. Maybe some of these instincts already existed. But the government, instead of reaching out to other countries, and also you have to remember about Russia, there's a huge demographic crisis, about 10 million people less population than it was a decade ago. So instead of reaching out to other places and making sure there's a steady stream of immigrants from abroad to rejuvenate the population, the government is doing is turning inward. And that is terrible.
Well, you've taken us on a big tour through it. It really is a tremendous satire, a heck of a send-up, and a great read. I'll keep you right up there on horseback with Walter Kern. Gary Steingart, we wish you well with your next work, and thanks so much for coming in with
Thank you
with
so
us
much.
This hour. Gary Steingart's new novel is Absurdistan. This is On Point.